shuddered. Daughter. That creature daring to call me daughter, daring to fling at me the name that had been my mother's, Mrs. Smolinski. And yet, if father was in trouble, I had to go. Shining in a new silk waist, she opened the door. Her fat bosom bulged like a pillow under her heavy double chins. She led me to the front room and pointed to a red velvet Morris chair for me to sit down. The flat, with its new gaudy furniture, new red carpet, hit me like an insult. I thought of the broken rags of things with which mother had to keep house. I thought of those freezing winter mornings when mother had to get up before everybody and shake out the ashes from a cold grate and with freezing fingers start up the coal fire, if we were lucky enough to have coal. And this woman living in a steam-heated flat with all the comforts of the world, bought with mother's death money. Forcing down my indignation, I asked, "What's the trouble?" "There's trouble enough," she burst out indignantly. "Your father don't earn a cent. He gives me nothing to live on. There's not a penny in the house since yesterday. What will become of us? How is the old man going to get along if you children have deserted him?" "Where's all father's lodge money?" "What about this furniture? I had to fix up a new house, and it all cost money." She began to weep hysterically. "You think your father married a poor servant girl? I was a princess by my first husband. I had servants nicer than some schoolteachers, and the fancy clothes my first husband used to buy me. When I walked out, I shined up the block with my style. Everybody turned their necks to give a look on me. What did your father buy me outside of a fur coat and this diamond cluster ring? He promised me earrings and everything, and give a look only on my empty ears." Dumb with disgust, I glanced at her huge ears. An overdressed, overfed cow, and she father's wife. As she sat down, the buttons burst open from the bulging bosom of her waist. Pink ribbons peeped out from a new corset cover. Silk stockings, new shoes, all mother's death money on her back, and she demanding more. Like a leech.
"Do you mean to say you've spent all the lodge money in this short time?"
"What?" she shrieked. "Accounts I should give you? What was your poor father, a millionaire? He had a few rotten dollars and it's long spent already."
Oh, my poor mother. If but one day in her lifetime she would have had half the things this woman owned now, how happy she would have been.
"He told me that all his children would put enough money together to keep him in comfort," the woman went on. "And on that I got married. I could have picked myself out a younger man, but your father promised me such riches." In a fury, I jumped to my feet. Father had money from four lodges, enough to keep him a lifetime. If he were in need and alone, we would have supported him. But we can't keep two people.
I rushed for the door, but she clutched my arm and held me back.
"You mean you'll not support your old father?" she screamed. "I'm married to better myself. I'm not his servant to wait on him for nothing. If you and your sisters won't support him, I'll tell the charities. I'll tell them by the Board of Education that you refuse to support your old father."
"Go ahead. Do your worst. We'd pay father's board if he lived alone, but we'll not keep two people in luxury."
"The heartlessness of his children, talking luxury when he don't give me enough for bread."
Father's entrance at that moment turned her rage from me toward him.
"You want your dinner yet?" she shouted at him in her shrill voice. "This is your last meal unless you bring me money. Your children don't want to support you. So to the court I'll go and have you arrested for not bringing me in a living."
"Zeresh! Snake!"
Father spat his contempt in her face.
"I've just come from the lawyer. He told me no man over 60 can be arrested for not earning money for his wife. You're younger and healthier, and they'll put you to work to support me. Thank God some laws of America are yet made by men."
At sight of me, father's angry voice ceased. Like a child, he turned to me for sympathy.
"Hear her only, the vulture. What does she want from me? I should go to work. I should bring her money."
The woman lifted a towel from the chair as if to throw it at father, but her hand dropped, and the towel fell to the floor.
"Woe is me," she sobbed into her apron. "All I ask of you is to be a man like other men. Pay the rent, give me bread, buy me a decent dress.
I married to better myself.
Father turned his back on her and began to talk to me. You see, daughter, how I fell in with a dummox? Can I sit down to eat or look into a book? I've got to get rid of this curse on me.
God is my witness. I don't want to fight with you, she wailed. But it's coming a holiday all over the world. In a few more days will be New Year. I ask you only, as a man with God in his heart, with what can I show my face before the neighbors? When they'll see me, they'll only laugh. Ha! She married an old crazy, and such a beggar. She hasn't from him even a new dress for the holidays.
Sobs drowned her torrent of words. Bucketfuls of tears seemed to flow out of her eyes.
What have I from my life since I married you? I'm ashamed to go among people. The first thing I go anywhere, they give a look on my empty ears. They got no respect for me because they see me with empty ears. The butcher's wife, even the rag pickers, they all got diamond earrings.
Ishara,
should I steal or rob to bring you diamond earrings?
A good husband steals and robs even, only to give his wife what's coming to her. I'm a young woman yet. I want to live. I thought if I'd have a husband, I'd have a man who'd be company and pleasure.
Servant. Cow, he hissed furiously. I should be your company? Could you, with your dumb head, your thick flesh, ever understand what's under the nail of my littlest finger?
Then why did you hurry so much to marry me?
I wanted someone to cook for me, to wash for me, to carry the burden of my house for me.
You wanted to warm up your old age with my youngness, and now I'm not worth to you the dirt under your feet.
A loud knock interrupted the quarrel. A man came with a bill.
There, she cried, snatching the paper. Already 2 weeks and the groceries not paid.
Why not paid? You got enough yet in Lemonovsky's bank to start yourself a business.
Do you make me for a liar and thief? I already have consumption. My heart is affected from your meanness.
I want my money,
the man demanded.
What for are you wasting my time? You got so much for new furniture and carpet? Why not first pay your grocery bill?
She motioned to the man to follow her in the hall. Through the crack in the door, I saw her fumble in her stocking, take out a bill from a thick wad, and hand it to the grocer. But when she returned, she was weeping as loudly as ever.
You think I'll slave away my young years for you for nothing? You'll not drive me to an early grave as you did your first wife.
Thing of evil! Don't dare take that saint's name in your evil mouth. You're not worth to speak her name.
He staggered to a chair and lifted his eyes in supplication.
God of the universe, have I not always done your will? What sin have I committed here on earth? How could you have created such an Ishara and sent her on my head?
What was there for me to do? Useless for me to interfere or try to make peace between them. Blind with tears, I rushed from the room, down the stairs, straight to Bessie's house. When I told my sisters of the woman's demands that we support her, they flared up in indignation.
Support that woman, cried Fanya. I'd sooner throw my money in the gutter.
It would dishonor mother's memory if we gave that leech a cent, declared Bessie.
As you made your bed, so you got to sleep in it, quoted Masha with scorn.
That's what he used to tell us. Now let him have a taste of his own preaching.
But as I came back to my quiet, sunny room, my heart ached for father. What was my duty? Was it to give my hard-earned school money to this woman healthy enough to go to work? If she married father to have it easy, was it not her own mistake? I tried to still my conscience with reason, but my heart ached with the unceasing question. What will become of father if we abandon him to the mercy of that woman? Chapter 20. Hugo Selig. The windows of my classroom faced the same crowded street where 17 years ago I started out my career selling herring. The same tenements with fire escapes full of pillows and feather beds. The same weazened, tawny-faced organ grinder mechanically turning out songs that were all the music I knew of in my childhood. How intoxicating were those old tunes of the hurdy-gurdy. I'd leave my basket of herring in the middle of the sidewalk, forget all my cares, and leap into the dance with that wild abandon of the children of the poor. But more even than the music of the hurdy-gurdy was the inspiring sight of the teacherin as she passed the street.
How thrilled I felt if I could brush by teacher's skirt and look up into her face as she passed me. If I was lucky enough to win a glance or a smile from that superior creature, how happy I felt for the rest of the day. I had it ingrained in me from my father, this exalted reverence for the teacher. Now I was the teacher. Why didn't I feel as I had supposed this superior creature felt? Why had I not the wings to fly with? Where was the vision lost? The goal was here. Why was I so silent, so empty? All labor now, and so far from the light. I longed for the close human touch of life again. My job was to teach, to feed hungry children. How could I give them milk when my own breasts were empty? Maybe after all my puffing myself up that I was smarter, more self-sufficient than the rest of the world, wasn't Father right? He always preached a woman alone couldn't enter heaven.
It says in the Torah, a woman without a man is less than nothing. No life on earth, no hope of heaven.
Not one of the teachers around me had kept the glamour. They were just peddling their little bit of education for a living, the same as any pushcart peddler. But no, there was one in this school who was what I had dreamed a teacher to be. The principal, Mr. Hugo Selig. He had kept that living thing, that flame that I used to worship as a child, and yet he had none of the aloof dignity of a superior. He was just plain human. When he entered a classroom, sunlight filled the place. How had he created that big spirit around him? What a long way I had to go yet before I could become so wholly absorbed in my work as he. The youngest, dirtiest child in the lowest grade he treated with the same courtesy and serious attention as he gave to the head of the department. One of Mr. Selig's special hobbies was English pronunciation, and since I was new to the work, he would come in sometimes to see how I was getting on. My children used to murder the language as I did when I was a child of Hester Street, and I wanted to give them that better speech that the teachers in college had tried to knock into me. Sometimes my task seemed almost hopeless. There was A.B. Zucker, the brightest 11-year-old boy in my class of 50. He had the neighborhood habit of ending almost every sentence with, "Ain't it?" For his special homework, I had given him a sentence with the words, "Isn't it?" to be written 100 times. The next morning, he brought it back and with a shining face declared, "I got it all right now, teacher, ain't it?" "Oh, A.B.," I cried. "And you want to be a lawyer. Don't you know the judges will laugh you out of court if you plead your case with ain't it?" Poor A.B. His little finger scratched his mop of red curls in puzzlement. From his drooping figure I turned, laughing, to the class. "Now, children, let's see how perfectly we can pronounce the words we went over yesterday." On the board I wrote, "S-I-N-G." "A.B., pronounce this word."
"Singa," said A.B.
"Sing," I corrected.
"Singa,"
came from A.B. again. "Rosie Stein, you can do better. Show our lawyer how to speak. Make a sentence with the word sing."
"The Boyd singa."
"Rosie, say bird."
"Boyd,"
repeated small Rosie with great distinctness.
"Boyd."
"Wrong still," I laughed. "Children, how do you pronounce this?" And I wrote hastily on the board, "Oil."
"Earl,"
cried the class triumphantly. "You know how to make the right sounds for these words, but you put them in the opposite places." And I began to drill them in pronunciation. In the middle of the chorus, I heard a little chuckle. I turned to see Mr. Selig himself, who had quietly entered the room and stood enjoying the performance. I returned his smile and went right on. "You try it again, Rosie. The bird singa." "Sing," corrected Mr. Selig softly. There it was. I was slipping back into the vernacular myself. In my embarrassment, I tried again and failed. He watched me as I blundered on. The next moment, he was close beside me, the tips of his cool fingers on my throat.
"Keep those muscles still until you have stopped. Now say it again."
he commanded.
And I turned pupil myself and pronounced the word correctly. As he was leaving the room, he turned to me with great gentleness and said, "When you dismiss the class, will you step into my office? I must see you."
The door closed. I tried to go on with the work, but my mind kept going round and round. The one thought, "I'm going to see him at 3. What has he to say to me? Was something wrong with my work?" And yet he seemed pleased and so gentle.
His face,
the features, all fineness and strength, the keen, kind gray eyes, a Jewish face, and yet none of the greedy eagerness of Hester Street any more. It was the face of a dreamer, set free in the new air of America.
Not like father with his eyes on the past, but a dreamer who had found his work among us of the East Side. For the next hour I was more rattle-brained than my worst children. How could I come down to geography and spelling?
I kept looking at the clock, counting the minutes to 3. The bell rang. Thank God, it was time to dismiss the class.
I took a quick look at myself in the mirror, powdered my face, straightened my hair, and hurried to Mr. Seelig's office. The moment I stepped into the room, I was brought to my senses by the cold, businesslike atmosphere. Mr. Seelig rose from his chair. Gravely, without even a word of greeting, he handed me an opened letter.
"Perhaps you had better read this."
And this is what I read.
"To the Mr. Principal, School for the Public. I want you to know about Sarah Smolinski, who let her own father starve and no rent, so he should be thrown in the street to shame and to laughter for the whole world. Is it not a disgrace for the schools from America that you have a teacher in learning the children who is such a mean stingy to her own blood? If you have the fear of God in your heart, you will yourself see that at least half her wages should go to her poor old father, who is a smarter man as she is a teacher in."
Every drop of blood seemed to leave my heart. My first impulse was to cry out to him, "It's false, all false," and pour out to him the whole story of my wretched life. But I simply stood there trembling like a guilty thing. How could I ever make clear to him my father? The blackness upon me was like the last gasp of drowning. It's the end. He despises me. He'll send me from his school. Mr. Seelig must have seen how I stood crushed with shame, for when I looked up, his head was turned. He was busy reading papers on his desk, as if he had forgotten that I was there. I fled the room. Did he call me? I thought he spoke my name, but I had no strength to turn and look at him. My hate for father, which mother's death had softened, boiled up in me like poison. Never would I look at him or his wife again. A blackmailer, a bloodsucker, that's what she was. This disgrace which they had heaped on me was the bottom end. I wanted to tear the roots of my father out of my flesh and bones, force my heart and brain to blot him out of my soul. But through that night of suffering, even hate bled out of me. I was a ruined thing without purpose, without hope. I was no more. The next day was lead. Mechanically, I dragged my feet to school. Mechanically, I went through the routine of the classwork, but the children were so much dead wood in front of me. What I was saying to them or what they were answering made no difference. I was so tired. I saw nothing, heard nothing. And yet what was left of me was waiting for the worst to happen. Condemned to lose my job, my life, condemned by him. 3 o'clock came. The blow had not yet fallen. Today, at least, I could get back to my little place and hide myself from my shame. The children seemed to crawl out of the room instead of running as usual. A.B. Zucker and Rosie Stein lingered with questions about their homework. It was as if they were trying to spite my misery. At last they were all out, and yet I had no energy to move. I stood paralyzed, waiting. Suddenly, my breath stopped. There, Mr. Seelig. I felt him come in and I couldn't look up. Let him dismiss me. I was dead anyway. After a moment, I dared lift my eyes. Why, he was smiling.
"I have a compliment for you. Mrs. Stein says that Rosie is a changed girl since she had been in your class."
I just couldn't speak.
It was all I could do to meet his eyes. That dreadful letter. He seemed to have forgotten all about it. He was still my friend.
We walked out of the building together. At the street corner, he turned to me.
Do you take the L or car?
He asked.
I usually walk home.
So do I.
He smiled.
I think we go in the same direction.
We fell into step, and for many blocks, not a word passed between us.
I only felt an enveloping friendliness going out of his heart to mine.
A sudden commotion, wild shrieks jerked us out of ourselves to the street around us. A little boy who ran madly into the middle of the street for his rolling marble was caught in the crowding traffic.
Mr. Selig and I rushed over in one breath and dragged him almost from under the wheels of a racing truck.
Before we could get to the curb, a woman, weeping and laughing hysterically, snatched the child from us.
Gazlin! Murderer!
How you blacken me my days!
She cried, shaking and cuffing him. Tatten you!
Only to get rid of this devil once and for all!
It was some moments before we could rescue the child from the animal fury of the mother. And afterwards we became aware that we had gripped each other's hands fiercely. Something in what happened had drawn us suddenly together. We were too filled for small talk the rest of the way, and before we knew it, we had reached 30th Street and stood before my house.
We've arrived. I think both of us deserve some tea after our exciting adventure.
I fairly ran in joy and rushed to my room a whole flight of stairs ahead of him to see that everything was in order. I snatched up the stockings and wash I had drying on the radiator and threw them in the basket. All excitement, I opened the door and showed off my room for the first time. My plain room that I loved. How would it look to another? Anxiously, I watched him as he looked slowly around.
How beautiful and empty, he cried.
I sighed with happiness. Years ago, I vowed to myself that if I could ever tear myself out of the dirt, I'd have only clean emptiness. He nodded understandingly. How great it felt to break my long loneliness and warm up my home with another presence. I lit the lamp under the tea kettle for the first time for two instead of one.
I like your nice dishes, he said as we sat down.
Because I live alone, I must have my table beautiful. It's company.
We got to talking about ourselves, our families, the old world from which we came. To our surprise, we found that our beginnings were the same. We came from the same government in Poland, from villages only a few miles apart. Our families had uprooted themselves from the same land and adventured to the new world. For a moment, we looked at each other, breathless with the wonderful discovery.
Landsleute! Countrymen!
We cried, in one voice, our hands reaching out to each other.
What do you remember of Poland?
He asked in a low voice.
Nothing. Nothing at all. Back of me, it's like black night.
I remember a little, he said. The mud hut where we lived, the cows, the chickens, and all of us living in one room. I remember the dark, rainy morning we started on our journey, how the whole village, old and young, turned out to say goodbye. When we came to the seaport, I couldn't eat their bread because it had no salt. We thought we should starve going to America. But as soon as we got on the ship, they gave us so much that first meal that we couldn't touch another bite for days.
After that, all differences dropped away.
We talked one language. We had sprung from one soil.
How strangely things work out,
I said with a new feeling of familiarity.
You got this blackmailing letter, and yet here we are, born friends.
Why shouldn't we be? You and I. We are of one blood.
We fell into silence. All the secret places of my heart opened at the moment, and then the whole story of my life poured itself out of me to him. Father, mother, my sisters, and father's wife with her greed for diamond earrings. As I talked, my whole dark past dropped away from me. Such a sense of release. Now I could go on and on. I could never again be lonely.
I understood everything the moment I read that letter, he said. It's queer how people get to know one another. That mean letter instead of turning me against you, drew me to you. I knew you weren't that kind. As for your father, I know just the kind of an old Jew he is. After all, it's from him that you got the iron for the fight you had to make to be what you are now.
I looked at him in wide wonder. What a mind reader you are. You understand not only me, but even my father, whom you've never yet seen. He used to call me Blut und Eisen. And then I told him of the hard heart, how I had to cut out everything soft in my life, only to survive. He took hold of both my hands.
You hard? You've got the fiber of a strong, live spruce tree that grows in strength the more it's knocked about by the wind. When men go to sea, they set the spruce for their mast.
We had lost all sense of time, and it was dusk when he rose to go.
Next time when we are together, we must spend it outdoors, he said, and try to remember more about Poland.
Next time. So there was going to be a next time, my heart rejoiced. I stood looking at his chair, feeling him still in the room for hours after, and my last feeling as I closed my eyes was, I'm no longer alone. I'm no longer alone.
In the early morning when I swept, my broom halted at Hugo Seelig's muddy footprint. He leaped up at me out of that spot on the floor. I felt again his voice. I saw again his eyes as he looked at me. You and I, we are of one blood.
Chapter 21 Man Born of Woman. One day, 3 months later, I walked out of school. It was a cold, drizzling rain, but my heart sang with the gladness of sunshine. That night, Hugo was coming to have dinner with me. Why were my years of lonely struggle unlit by the hope that I might someday be as happy as I was now? Why did I ever feel cheated and robbed of the life that more fortunate girls seemed to have? And here I had so much more than my heart could hold. But as I walked along through Hester Street toward the Third Avenue L, my joy hurt like guilt. Lines upon lines of pushcart peddlers were crouching in the rain. Backs bent, hands in their sleeves, ears under their collars, grimy faces squeezed into frozen masks. They were like animals, helpless against the cold, pitiless weather. Wasn't there some way that I could divide my joy with these shivering pushcart peddlers, grubbing for pennies in the rain? I felt like Carnegie and Rockefeller trying to give away the millions they could not spend. Why was my happiness so hard to be enjoyed? I felt like one sitting down to a meal while all the people around him were howling hungry. I felt as if all the beauty of the world that ever was ached in me to pour itself out on the people around. I felt like the sun so afire with life that it can't help but shine on the whole world, the just and the unjust alike. A longing to see Father came over me. What had happened to him in all those months? I could stifle my conscience no longer. Wife or no wife, I had to see what I could do for him. Even his wife I could not hate any more, for after all, it was her blackmailing letter that had opened Hugo's eyes to me.
Poor woman. Poor people of Hester Street.
With new pity I looked at them. I hurried on, but the verve of my winged walk was dulled by the thick, shuffling tread of those who walked beside me. My own shoulders, that I always held so straight, sagged because of the bowed backs that hemmed me in. The sadness of it chilled the glow I usually felt when I got to my peaceful room. Hugo's red roses on my table. Almost I could have wept for them, so full and rich with lovely color, so heartlessly perfect, so shamelessly beautiful that it hurt to look at them. I didn't want them if they were only for me. I leaned out of the open window and saw the city as it lay below me, sharp and black and grimy. The smoke of those houses kept rising sullenly until I couldn't help but breathe the soot of that far-reaching tragedy below.
Ach, you, with your always guilty conscience! Why can't you be happy when you're lucky enough to have a little respite of happiness? Why do you have to make yourself so miserable because for the first time in your life you know a little bit of love? Fool! Get yourself dressed.
I threw off my dark school dress and put on my new challis. I turned to the mirror. How becoming was that soft green with that touch of rose embroidery? How well it suited my pale skin and dark hair that I learned to braid so becomingly around my head. I hope Hugo will like it. The telephone rang. It was Hugo telling me that he was held up by the Board of Education meeting and asking me to join him at Orloff's Cafe on East Broadway. So happy I was in a moment. Forgotten were the sorrows of the world. How could I most quickly get to him? I ran to the car, but when I got off at Grand Street, I was blocked by the usual jam of evening traffic. I stood impatiently on the corner with a crowd of people, waiting for the policeman to stop the stream of trucks and taxis. As his whistle sounded, and we rushed for the other side, I was shoved against an old man with a tray of chewing gum. The sudden impact knocked his wares out of his hands. In spite of my excited haste to get to Hugo, I stopped to help the old man pick up the rolling packages. With my fresh handkerchief, I wiped the mud from each piece and dropped it back into his tray.
Thank you, lady.
At the sound of that voice, my heart leaped as though a red-hot knife had been thrust into it. The old man's face was half hidden in the collar of his shabby coat. His bony fingers trembled as he recovered his soiled stock. But I knew that face. Those hands. Father! You? You here? He fell back against the door and stared at me, the sorrows of the whole world in his tragic eyes.
Well. Well,
he jerked out, his teeth clacking together with the cold.
Let the world see the shame that my daughters heaped on me. What's an old father to heartless American children? Have they any religion, any fear of God? Do they know what it means, honor thy father? What else can I do to support myself and her? She drove me out to bring her in money.
You let that woman boss you? I burst out furiously.
Have I children like other people's children who carry their father like a crown on their heads? Have they provided for me as God-fearing children provide for an old father? With all I have done for my daughters, the morals I soaked into them, the religion I preached into them from the day they were born, yet they leave me in my old age as they left King Lear, broken, forgotten. God, what have I sinned to come to this? I, Reb Smolinski, down among the pushcarts.
How changed he was. How old and suffering. He, the master, with the stoop of poverty on his back. And I had been so happy. He began to cough, shivering with the cold. His days are counted, my heart cried. Who would nurse him and watch over him?
That woman?
Mother's dying eyes rose before me. Her last words, be good to father. I leave him in his old age, when he needs me most, helpless as a child he is. I looked at father with mother's eyes. I saw in him only the child who needed mothering, who must be protected from the hard cruelties of the world. Come, I said, fighting back the tears. It's raining hard. Let's better go.
Where? Where shall I go? In your house shall I go?
I'll take you home. I'll see that you get what you need. I took his arm and led him away. He trembled against me as we trudged along. When I looked into his face, his eyes were half closed and his lips blue. He did not speak. He walked on in silence, proud as ever. At his door I stopped. All visions of doing things for him were checked by that door. That woman! How I dreaded facing her! But he needs me. To hell with my feelings. He needs me. I opened the door with determination and walked in. Thank God she was not around. I could help him. He sank back weakly in his chair, and he let me take off his wet shoes and the torn rags of stockings that clung to his old feet. Supporting himself on me, he staggered to the bed. As I tucked the covers around him, I felt the shrunken bones where once the rounded flesh had been. How he had wasted since mother had died. How neglected he looked. How helpless. He's like a poor orphan with a stepmother. I had hated him. But where was that hate now?
Whom else had he in this world if not me? How could I leave him in his need?
Tears strained in my throat as I bent over him, offering him some hot tea, but he pushed away the glass, muttering deliriously. In a panic, I left him and ran for the doctor. How could I have hated him and tried to blot him out of my life? Can I hate my arm, my hand, that is part of me? Can a tree hate the roots from which it sprang? Deeper than love, deeper than pity, is that oneness of the flesh that's in him and in me. Who gave me the fire, the passion to push myself up from the dirt? If I grow, if I rise, if I ever amount to something, is it not his spirit burning in me? When I returned, the woman was there. She met me with hostile daggers in her eyes and a shower of reproaches.
Now, when your father is already dying, now you come to him, she shouted. When weeks and months passed and we were starving, you did not come near. Now, when he has only a few hours to live, now you come, dear, kind, good-hearted, dutiful daughter.
I paid no attention to her, but went to father's bedside. He was burning with fever, groaning and gasping for breath.
And what'll become of me now that he's dying?
She began to howl at the top of her voice. The doctor came and examined him. As I saw him sitting by the bed, I realized that he was the same doctor who had attended to mother. I recalled the day when he had advised her to have her foot amputated. Mother's dying eyes. The gray, cold face in the coffin. Through fogs of fear, I struggled to think how best to take care of father. Should I hire a nurse or get a leave of absence from school? But the woman's howling lamentations would not let me think.
What has God against me? She wailed. What sin have I done? Haven't I always been a good woman, an honest woman, a virtuous woman? Haven't I nursed my first husband to his grave? Haven't I done all my duties to him, my second husband? God, my God, why is it coming to me to be a widow the second time?
The doctor stopped her impatiently. This is no time for noise, he said. If you want your husband to get well, give him quiet.
It was not necessary to get a nurse, he thought, or even for me to be absent from school. The woman could wait on him the first part of the day, and I could take my turn in the afternoon and evening. The minute school was over, next day I rushed back.
Your father is worse, his wife greeted me. He refuses to take his medicine. Maybe he can't swallow any more. He's an old man, and it's his end.
In her eyes I seemed to see a look of secret triumph. Soon, those eyes said. He'll die, and I'll have his lodge money to marry again. Shuddering, I turned from her and hurried over to father. Yes, he was worse. His eyes were closed, his cheeks burning.
Father,
I stroked his hot hand gently, you must take this medicine. It will take away your fever and stop your cough. His dull eyes opened and gazed up at me pitifully.
I'll take it from you. Only stay with me, he begged. I'm afraid to take the medicine from her. She might do something.
His fingers closed on my arm to pull me nearer to him, but the strength had gone from that dominating hand. In weakness and helplessness, the poor flesh clung desperately to me.
I'm all alone, he whispered. She isn't like mother. She's only waiting for my death.
A cough shook him. He groaned with pain. At the sound of his voice, she hurried out of the kitchen.
Where does it hurt you? Are you feeling worse? She asked.
No. No, I'm better.
In her presence, he tried to control his groans and hide his pain. He even struggled to sit up. His hand clutched at the bosom of my dress.
Bring me my book, he whispered.
I brought it to him. His feeble fingers caressed the worn, yellowed pages of his beloved book of Job. With his last strength, his faded eyes strained to drink in the words that were his life. Anxiety and lack of sleep had exhausted me, and in spite of myself, I dozed off at the foot of his bed. Then, through the haze of semi-consciousness, I heard the woman pleading slyly,
"Tell me only, where do you keep your lodge papers? Is there anyone who owes you money? Maybe you got yet insurance on your life?
Leave me alone. His faint voice reached me. I breathe yet.
But you're in God's hands. You can't tell what may happen to you the next minute. Don't forget it, you're a very sick man and very old. You haven't the strength to fight a sickness like a younger man.
In a flash, I was awake and on my feet. Never again while Father was alive would I leave him alone with her. Hugo quickly got me a leave of absence from school. Night and day until he was well, I stayed in that house with my father. Day by day, I won his confidence and a sort of dependent affection. His old talkativeness returned. He told me legends of the Bible and explained the wisdom of the Torah. In more intimate moments, he told me of his unhappiness with his wife.
The sages of the Talmud said, a man has a right to divorce his wife if she don't salt him his soup to his taste. And mine is guilty of worse offenses. She's selfish and wants to live for herself instead of living only for her husband. I thought if I'd marry a young one, she'd have strength to work for me, he went on. But she only wants pleasure and luxuries of the flesh. So maybe it would be better for me to go to an old men's home where I could spend my last days in peace instead of living with a false wife who reminds me always that I'm old.
To please him, I went next day to the old men's home. It was a beautiful building. But the moment I entered, the loveless, inhuman, institutional atmosphere struck me like a blow. They showed me the place. Clean. Cold. Choking with orderliness. Beds all in a row, spotless, creaseless, like beds in an orphan asylum. I saw groups of old men sitting lifelessly on hard wooden benches.
How much better off they are here than living by themselves,
said the official, rubbing his hands.
They eat only food that's best for them, and their meals and their sleep are at regular hours. It's like a sanitarium for their last days.
But the very things the man praised up to me made me shudder. No, this institutional prison was not for my father. Never would I allow him to have his will broken in such a place. He, who all his life had his own way, must continue to have it to the end of his days. If he wanted to leave his wife, let him go to board somewhere where he can have his own room, his books around him, free to come and go as he wishes. Here, in this prison, were rules and regulations that he could never endure. My father would never stoop to ask permission to go out and to report when he got back. He would never obey the iron rule not to upset his bed all day long. He would want to go to bed, or get up at any time of day or night as he pleased. He should have a place that suited him. And not with his wife. I came back to Father's house. As I opened the door, I could not believe my eyes. There was his wife on her knees, putting on his shoes for him. She was lacing them patiently and making the double knots, just as he dictated. I watched her with wide eyes. This was something new. It took me a minute or two to take it all in. I suddenly realized that this woman I hated was necessary to him. He could not live alone in a boarding house any more than in the old men's home. He needed a wife to wait on him. It came to me that if we tried not to hate her, to be a little kind to her, maybe she would be more faithful to Father. I followed her into the kitchen and put $10 into her hand. I'm going to give you this each week, and I'll see that my sister should give you $10 more regularly. Only take good care of Father. Her eyes glowed with gladness as she seized the bills.
Sure, she said. If I only get enough money in my hands, I know how to live good. You think I want him to die? Is it nice for me to bury already my second husband? But how could we live if you children had no hearts?
She became a new person, as the money came to her regularly. In a very few months, the coveted earrings appeared in her thick ears. She got what she wanted in this world. A gloating look of smiling satisfaction came to her face. As she waddled with her basket to the market, she tossed her head coquettishly from side to side, showing off the glittering earrings to the passers-by. Soon we all began to visit Father's house and met his wife without hostility. We tried to make up with presents for the lack of real, warm friendliness that we could not feel. Once I brought her a box of fruit for the New Year holiday.
and in return she made me taste her apple strudel. At that moment most of the old hostility vanished from my heart. Next time I came with Hugo. "Father, this is Mr. Selig," I said, watching to see how the two would take to each other.
Father shook his hands and scrutinized him inquisitively. "Mr. Selig, from where do you come?"
"Varshe Gubernia." "A long time ago," Hugo added with a smile.
"And your parents with you here? By what do you work?"
"Mr. Selig is a principal of a school," I interposed.
"So, a principal?"
Father shook hands again with new respect.
"Do they pay you good?"
"Well," sighed Hugo, getting into Father's spirit,
"I make a living, but I'm not smart enough yet. And I came to ask you, would you care to teach me Hebrew?" "Hebrew? An American young man, a principal, and wants to learn Hebrew? And you want me to teach you?" "If a learned man like you would care to take a beginner like me."
Father leaned back in his chair. The old dream look came back into his glowing eyes.
"Listen to me, Mr. Selig, young man. I want you to know I don't trust much American young men. They're all deniers of God. One day is the same to them as another. Ask them the difference between a plain Monday and the Sabbath, and they'll gape at you."
His eyes grew soft and moist. He looked most gratefully from Hugo toward me.
"I thought that in America we were all lost. Jewishness is no Jewishness. Children are no children. Respect for fathers does not exist. And yet my own daughter, who is not a Jewess and not a Gentile, brings me a young man. And whom? An American. And for what? To learn Hebrew. From whom? From me. Lord of the universe, you never forsake your faithful ones."
His old eyes widened with a glance of sudden understanding, and he looked from Hugo to me, and from me back to Hugo.
"Even my daughter with the hard heart has come to learn that the words of our holy Torah are the only words of life. These words were true ages and ages ago, and will yet be true for ages and ages to come. Our forefathers have said, 'A woman without a man is less than nothing. A woman without a man can never enter heaven.'"
The old pride flamed up in his face.
"Woman," he called ecstatically to his wife, "show only this American young man all my holy books in the bedroom."
Hugo's eyes sought mine. With a look of awe, he followed the woman to the other room.
Delighted with the outcome, I turned to Father.
"Aren't you glad," I whispered, "that you didn't go to a home or a lonely room in a boarding house? Here you have your books and all the comforts of your own house, and her, ready to wait on you."
He wagged his head for a silent moment. Then an unbeaten fierceness came into his eyes. "Yes," he sighed ruefully. "It's like living in a beautiful garden with a snake in it. Never will I finish out my days with that woman. Can fire and water live together? Neither can a man of God live with a cow, an isha ra."
With his every word, my high spirit sank. My breathing spell of happiness was over. Just as I was beginning to feel safe and free to go on to a new life with Hugo, the old burden dragged me back by the hair. Was there no place in the whole world for Father? My home. Must I give it up to him?
But with him there, it would not be home for me. I suddenly realized that I had come back to where I had started 20 years ago when I began my fight for freedom. But in my rebellious youth, I thought I could escape by running away. And now I realized that the shadow of the burden was always following me. And here I stood face to face with it again.
"Father," I ventured hesitatingly, "would you care to live with me?"
He looked at me, and in that look I felt the full force of his unbending spirit. "Can a Jew and a Christian live under one roof? Have you forgotten your sacrilege, your contempt for God's law, even on the day of your mother's death? I must keep my Sabbath holy, I cannot have my Eden contaminated with your carelessness.
He paused.
But if you'll promise to keep sacred all that is sacred to me,
he went on, in an attempt to be tolerant,
then, maybe, I'll see. I'll think it over.
I almost hated him again as I felt his tyranny, the tyranny with which he tried to crush me as a child. Then suddenly the pathos of this lonely old man pierced me. In a world where all is changed, he alone remained unchanged, as tragically isolate as the rocks. All that he had left of life was his fanatical adherence to his traditions.
It was within my power to keep lighted the flickering candle of his life for him.
Could I deny him this poor service?
Unconsciously, my hand reached out for his. The look of bitterness faded from his face, and he opened the Bible, his eternal consolation. Instantly, he was transported to his other world. Hugo returned, and Father glanced up with stern absent-mindedness from his book to bid us goodbye.
I could hardly wait till we got out of the room to tell Hugo about Father.
Of course the old man must come with us,
he exclaimed. Do you realize what you're saying? If he lives with us, we'll lose our home.
Not at all. Our home will be the richer if your father comes with us.
I laughed at his easy enthusiasm. He talked like a Tolstoyan. So there it was, the problem before us, the problem of Father, still unsolved. In the hall we paused, held by the sorrowful cadences of Father's voice.
Man born of woman is of few days and full of trouble.
The voice lowered and grew fainter till we could not hear the words anymore. Still we lingered for the mere music of the fading chant.
Then Hugo's grip tightened on my arm and we walked on.
But I felt the shadow still there over me. It wasn't just my father, but the generations who made my father, whose weight was still upon me.
This concludes Bread Givers by Anzia Yezerska. Narrated by Gabra Zachman. Copyright 1925 by Doubleday & Company, Incorporated. Copyright renewed 1952 by Anzia Yezerska, transferred to Louise Levitus Henriksen in 1970. Third edition, copyright 2003 by Percy Books, Incorporated. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Percy Books and was produced in the year 2017 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.